I want to welcome you, and we're about to dig in. I'm going to challenge some of you, and I'll try to go easy in some ways, and I'll do some poking and prodding. But I think you can take it. I have full confidence in you. As Sharon said, I come from Portland. I'll tell you a little bit more about why I'm interested in this topic and what brings me here. But I first want to have you think about this question. I invited those who were here at the beginning to fill in the blanks. I need a scribe. Can someone write?
I can write.
All right, awesome. Okay. Yeah, so when I talk about racism, I feel blank because blank. And what I would like you to do, please, is just to write, I feel blank. Write that emotion or whatever the feeling is that someone calls out. Why don't someone start out? I feel sad. Sad. Thank you.
Guilty.
Guilty.
Just waking up.
I feel just waking up.
Helpless.
Hopeless or helpless? Which one?
Uncertain.
Both
helpless and hopeless. And let him catch up here.
Angry.
Welcome. Let him catch up.
Angry.
I heard uncertain.
Uncertain. Angry.
Angry.
Empowered.
I heard foolish. What was that last one?
Empowered.
Embarrassed. Embarrassed.
Anxious.
I heard anxious.
Self-righteous. Awkward.
Awkward.
Complicit and responsible.
Complicit and responsible. What was that one?
Anxious.
Anxious. Did we get that up there?
Hopeful.
Okay, hopeful.
Inadequate.
Maybe a couple more, maybe one or two more.
Frustrated.
Prepared.
What's that last one?
Prepared.
Purveyor. Okay, purveyor.
Purveyor?
All right. Purveyor. Carrier. Conduit, if you will. Thank you. Awesome. Well, I've done this activity a couple of times, and I've always wrestled about how to do it, because when you do it this way, there's some kind of groupthink that happens, and when somebody sees a word come up on a board, they kind of think of a word that's similar to it. So, sorry about that, but I wanted to at least get these words on the board. Just take those words in for just a moment. You know what? Without labeling what kind of words are up there, what's the feeling, what's the kind of words that you see up there? A lot of negative words up there. Nobody finished it because I feel anxious or I feel just waking up, I feel uncertain because, not necessary to go there. But do you have one? Okay. So so this is the same exercise I did a couple months ago in another workshop, and you can see the words are not that different. Unprepared, depressed, sensitive, excited. Complicit, angry, tentative, uncomfortable, nervous, helpless, trapped, unforgivable. Well, those are some pretty powerful words. And so I know when I do a workshop like this, I'm already, there's a lot of emotion that comes into this room, and I want to respect that and acknowledge it, and know that I share those, many of those feelings with you. I feel unprepared. Though I've done a lot of study on this issue, I've been really at this work for 20 years since I pastored a church in St. Louis. It was technically speaking biracial, but it was not multicultural. It was basically two communities living or worshiping in the same congregation, struggling with each other and not really understanding each other very well in St. Louis. And then I'll tell you more about that in a moment. But thank you for those words. I appreciate you sharing those. This is our theme for the summer. Fear not. Do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. I want to hold you in this room. Know that I respect everything that's said in this room, and I expect and hope that you respect everything that other people say, and I really hope that some of you take risks in this room. And so, with that, let us pray. Gracious and loving God, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for being ever-present amidst our fear, our concern, our guilt, our foolishness, and our anger, our feeling of inadequacy, our awkwardness and self-righteousness. Thank you for being with us and help us not to fear, but to see opportunity where we can't see it right now. Help us to get to the top of the mountain by your grace and your guidance. In Christ's name, amen. My name is Chris Voss Rothmeyer. As Sharon said, I am a pastor in a different capacity right now in Portland. I teach middle school, so my congregation is actually a middle school in a public high school, a public middle school setting. I began that work 11 years ago after pastoring for 8 years before that in two churches in St. Louis and one in Portland, so a little south of Portland, a little town called Milwaukee. So that's what I bring professionally, I guess, to this workshop. But I want to know why you're here first. What brought you to this workshop? I didn't see anybody carried into this room kicking and screaming, so I assume you came in here on your own volition. And so I'm curious, why are you here?
It's a hot subject today.
Hard? It's a hot subject? Yeah.
As a teacher, I see it every day.
Okay. You see racism. Is that what you mean by it?
You see the manifestation of white privilege, and which is as a result of racism, and you know, it's all interconnected. You see that manifest itself in school every day.
I see it in the church.
Yeah, in the church. Go ahead.
We're trying to have conversations about it in our parish, and it's not going well.
Yeah, maybe the most important but most overlooked or misunderstood issue in the country.
Maybe. Maybe it's the most misunderstood issue in the country. We don't do it very well. Many congregations don't do it very well. Many people don't do it very well.
Continues to be the elephant in the room.
It's the elephant in the middle of the room. Well, who am I? You've heard a little bit about who I am. I grew up in a pretty monocultural environment. My dad was a professor in Hanover in Dartmouth College, and then Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, Pitt in Pittsburgh. So we moved around to different places, but I cannot recall a lot of places in my growing up where there was a lot of racial diversity. It wasn't part of my experience. Even when I went to Madison in Wisconsin, it was more diverse, but it wasn't really in my consciousness about how to talk and how to really engage in this issue. That changed, however, when I did some volunteer work for a year in a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C., with a community called the Community for Creative Nonviolence. And the shelter I lived in was about 14 people large, homeless men and women who were in the hospital that had no place to be released to except for the shelter that I lived in. And they were a diverse group of people from a variety of walks of life, some having lived very lavish and lush lives, lost everything through illness, and found themselves on the street. Racially very diverse group of people. And it got me kind of thinking, what is race relations? I read a book, I remember that year, a book called Black Like Me. Anybody ever read that book?
Yeah.
Interesting read, Black Like Me. And it's got me to start to thinking about race relations. I came here to Holden for a couple of years, and this is not a very racially diverse community, let me just put it that way. I kind of was expecting the audience that is here right now. A little bit of racial diversity here on from a cursory view. I'm just looking around the room. I don't know what your racial background is, but we as a society judge people based on that initial look. And from that initial look, it is basically what I grew up with right around here. Then I went to seminary right from Holden Village for 4 years. Met my wife Susan here, actually. We proposed, actually, right up there. Actually, we announced our proposal. And we proposed out there by the river sauna to each other. But we announced to the world for the first time right there, 26 years ago. We're about to... It's a little sideline. And then I went to seminary. A lot of diversity there. Took different classes in theology and multicultural understandings of the Hebrew Scriptures and the Second Testament. Then in my first call was a city church in St. Louis, inner city. I described it a little bit. It was two communities. There were African Americans in the community, and there were the old guard who had been there for, the church was about 120 years old, and they had been there for a long time, but did not communicate well. And that was, so I had participated wanting to understand that. I was fresh out of seminary, of course, give the new pastor the hardest job on the block. And I went to a week-long, intense anti-racism training in St. Louis. And got trained in that fashion and took some of that training back to my congregation. Didn't do much good. I got my proverbial butt kicked in that congregation still, like coal in a furnace. And I did not handle it. Didn't know what to do. Then moved to Portland. And Portland is pretty white. It's not very racially diverse anyway. Anybody ever been to Portland? All right, you know what I'm talking about. I pastored a church for 4 years, there 4.5 years, Milwaukee Presbyterian Church, and it was also relatively white. And then I decided I need to go out. I need to get out of this church, and I need to move into the world. And so I got a teaching certificate at Portland State and started to teach. And the church / school where I teach now is a very racially diverse congregation. I think of it as my congregation. I'm in the minority. I am white, but I am in the minority there. But here's the interesting thing. While the student body is largely Latino and African American and Asian and a number of different things, almost to a person, the teachers are all white. That's a stark contrast. And so 2 years ago, I put in my bio that I attended a year-long graduate certificate program to help me understand how to work with and understand students of color and underserved populations. It was an intense year, and I hope to be able to put some of that, and I have been putting some of that to use in the classroom, having conversations with students who want to have the kind of conversations we're about to have, who want to learn how to, who have told me they want to talk about race. They think it's the elephant in the room that's just not being discussed. So that's my challenge. And then just this year, I co-taught a class within the district, two other teachers in the district, called How to Talk About Race in the Classroom with another teacher. So that's going to be kind of ongoing. That's what I bring to this session here. It's a three-part series. The first part, we're going to just kind of get some language and some vocabulary down a little bit and just kind of understand a few things nuts and bolt-wise, and then we'll probably start to get into the actual history of itself. Not going to get very far, but we'll start. I've laid out some books right here. This is my reading over the last year or two. Many more to follow. It's just a few of the books that I thought would be interesting. I invite you to peruse as you see fit. And we'll dive into these two gentlemen here, W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. Interesting guys. Had a very interesting dialogue between each other in the early 1900s, late 1800s. informs us still today, I think. Okay. So these are just kind of some things that I am wanting to have us agree to do. Stay engaged. Try not to check out. I know it's hot in this room. I know you've just had dinner. It might be easy to fall asleep. I won't fault you if you do. I get it. It's about close to 6 o'clock in the evening. If you do, fine. But try to stay engaged, at least try to be, we'll do a little bit of group work, we'll do some walking around and that kind of thing as much as it's possible here on the fireside. Speak your truth responsibly and try to speak your truth. Try not to speak the truth of other people or try not to understand other people too much, but just say what you feel. I think that's most important. Listen to understand. You know, so many times when people are having a conversation, they're listening and then they're thinking in their heads, what am I going to say in response? How am I going to respond to this? And that's so tempting to do. And so I want to challenge you to just say, okay, just listen, empty the mind and just kind of listen to what the other person is saying without thinking, well, what's my response to that? Be willing to do things differently and experience discomfort. That's a tough one for us. We're not used to experiencing discomfort around this topic. Expect and accept non-closure. I'm not going to answer all your questions. I'm not prepared to answer all your questions. I will do my level best. But there is expertise in this room also, and if you have something to add, please do. Be confidential also. You know, as they say, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in this room stays in this room. And let other people tell their story if they want to take it outside the room. Okay? All right. Okay, three terms, white privilege. I need a reader. Jill, thank you.
White privilege, advantages that whites, people whom society labels as white, enjoy that POC, people of color, do not experience. Examples, cultural affirmations of one's worth, presumed greater social status, freedom to move, buy, work, play, and speak freely, the assumed universality of one's own cultural experience, perceiving oneself as normal, fragility, vulnerability.
We'll get into those. But anybody would just want to respond to that white privilege? I'm offering it as my definition. It's not the definition, but anybody want to respond to anything from that?
They have to know everything about white people culture, but white people don't have to know anything about anybody else's culture, because it's not going to affect them like white people culture would affect.
And they have to be bicultural, so to speak, as a matter of survival. They know their culture, but they also have to be able to have to negotiate what's out there. White privilege is... advantages that we, those of you who call yourself white, experience in this culture. I'll just put out there that I am, as you might have guessed, identify as a white male. I am Protestant, 53 years old, so I'm kind of heading toward, I don't know what, but I still feel young. And to many of you, I'm still quite young. And I'm able-bodied. I speak English pretty well, so that actually puts me at the front of the line in this culture, in many, many ways. So I am white privileged. You may find yourself in different places. Oh, I am vegetarian. That is actually something that it doesn't keep me from paying my mortgage, but it does put me in some awkward situations at times. Not at Holden. Right, thank you. I'm at home here.
That parallels to male white privilege. I think it's strong, you know, as women's movements trying to get consciousness across.
Yeah. Yeah. Society is geared to benefit me. People who look like me, talk like me, and I've come to accept that. I don't say that as, it's not a 12-step group, it's not AA or anything like that. I don't say it to kind of get your sympathy or anything like that. I'm saying it as a fact. To understand it is the beginning, if you will, to is the beginning of recovery, to use the 12-step language. Okay, well, I want to address this concept of fragility first of all. And a woman named Robin DiAngelo was the first one who coined this concept of white fragility in 2011. Anybody ever run across Robin DiAngelo's work? Yeah. So my brother-in-law right over here, Ron Dwyer Voss, is one that put me onto this article just a few days ago. Thank you. From the New Yorker. You're going to get it here in the bookstore before too long, but the library, July 23rd, so very recent. Robin DiAngelo just wrote a book called White Fragility. And so white fragility is the disbelieving defensiveness that white people exhibit when their ideas about race and racism are challenged, and particularly when they feel implicated in white supremacy. It's a sense of defensiveness and a deflectiveness. Oh, no, not me. I'm not one of those people. But yes, we are. I want to expand your horizons and vision to think white supremacists aren't just people who walk down the streets of Charlottesville carrying torches and shouting epithets. That's not what all white supremacy is about. It's about participation in the system that is in place. She goes on to kind of talk about, this is the New Yorker's reviewing this book, so these are just a couple of points about the book that are in it. Our society is set up to insulate whites from racial discomfort. As who said over here that when you wake up, Jill, did you say this?
Yeah.
When you wake up, you know, a person of color has to know two cultures, but a white person can just say, you know, if there's discomfort over there, I just turn my eyes, I have that ability, and that's white privilege. We have that privilege to be able to do that. We don't have to talk about this issue. You didn't have to come to this classroom. You didn't have to have me poke you and prod you to challenge you about this issue. I applaud you for doing it, but we don't have to do this. The social costs of pointing out discrimination by a person of color are so high that he or she often chooses not to do it. And so when someone of color chooses to point out something that is discriminatory or racist, holy smoke, the intestinal fortitude that it takes for that person to do that, you gotta respect that. Because that person has a potentially a great deal of backlash potential. So white fragility holds racism in place. White progressives, check this out. Cause the most daily damage to people of color. Those people who call themselves, I got it. I got this. Those are the people who are of the most concern to DiAngelo because they pride themselves in having arrived and in making sure that others recognize and acknowledge that also. Colorblindness. Race doesn't exist. I don't see color. I don't see race. We're all the same. How many of you have heard that? Prevents us from grappling with how it actually does matter. It does matter. Yes, it's a construct. Race is a construct. We'll talk about that. But it does matter, and it does impact us. I'm going to zip through here. Racism tries to hide itself in order to avoid detection. And if anybody ever read Walter Wink's book, Naming the Powers, where he talks about this system of evil that actually almost has a personification to it. It's almost like they reminded me of Walter Wink. She kind of described racism as this entity, as this personified entity that has a life force to it in order to survive. The most effective adaptation of racism over time is the idea that racism is conscious bias held by mean people. Those people. I won't name names, but maybe you can think of names. This good, bad, binary thinking is a racist construct. Progressives use it to avoid facing their collusion with racist system. All right. I'll just, a response. Or maybe what I'll have you do is I'll have you turn to somebody next to you and just respond to each other, and then we'll come back. Go ahead and just talk to each other about something that might have caught your attention, surprised you, annoyed you, anything.
I'll be back.
At this point in my classroom that I would have a little bell and I'd go ding. And my students would know when they hear that bell. As the bell is getting quieter and quieter, so are they.
Really?
Awesome. Well, it sounds like there's some good conversation there. Anybody want to call out, share out what you just shared with another person?
Well, I could say that recently when a woman who was taking care of some children, who was a black woman, came in to pick them up at an aftercare program, and I was in charge that day after my teaching of checking these kids out, and I reached out and touched her, and she said very clearly to me, "Please do not touch me unless you ask permission next time." And I must have gone through a whole Rolodex of fragility things of what she might be thinking about me, how I'm not that kind of person. And instead, I just said to her, "You are right. I will do that next time. Thanks for letting me know." And I couldn't have done that had I not had the past couple of years of thinking about this and about my own complicitness. It was a small thing, but instead of thinking how she's thinking of me and I am not that person, I just responded to her. Mm-hmm. Which, I'm not saying it felt good, I just, it felt very different than my previous self.
But what I really appreciate about that response is that you lived in the moment, you didn't get defensive, you said thank you. I really appreciate how you just kind of held that discomfort and didn't deflect it back to the other person. That was awesome.
So, you live in Portland, I live in Vancouver. You think Portland's like Vancouver.
Okay.
And my wife and I go down to downtown Portland on a frequent basis, frankly. And we don't like to drive down to Portland, so we'll jump on Mac. And so I get in my car, we drive over the bridge, we get on Mac, and a large number of people that ride Mac are of color. They're not, you don't see as many white families and white people on that. And it's that internal bias in my family who was out there, they just don't know. It's difficult for me to should I be watching where they sit in relation to where I'm sitting, and you know, feeling bad for myself and shaming myself internally for even thinking that. But it's almost impossible for me not to do that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate the vulnerability in that, the self-awareness too.
I just had a real quick story in response to yours. It reminded me of a woman I know of who had a class that was like, you know, a cultural, a race-related class, so it was pretty diverse. And at one point, she was meeting a black woman next to her, and she asked her name, and so she started calling her, you know, Janet, or whatever her name was, first name. And the woman said, don't call me, please don't call me by my first name. I'm Miss whatever. You know, kind of like you, like, really? What? And then she explained to her that I think maybe her mom had been a maid, and her whole life she was called Mary. She was never Miss so-and-so. And that happens with a lot of white people, just given first names is a real demeaning thing in many contexts. Mm-hmm. And so, while it was shocking to her initially, you know, later on that she learned the context, it made a lot more sense. So maybe it's something that's probably similar sorts of experiences or backgrounds.
Well, a lot of courage on that person's part to share her story.
Yeah, go ahead. White fragility, go ahead.
Maybe you don't know this answer because you didn't write that book, but I don't understand white progressives cause the most daily damage.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. I don't know if I'm completely over this, but when I get into a group of people, when I've been in some of the various trainings that I've been in, and some day long, some week long, and that kind of thing, I want to appear as I'm on board. You can trust me. I got my little pin on, my safety pin on, or I got my Black Lives Matter band on. You can trust me. But to the point where I say, you know, I'm on board, I got this. To that point, I stop my process and I become part of the problem, because I don't think any of us have gotten to the mountaintop. I don't think any of us are there yet. Sadly, we don't know that what that world looks like yet.
So I understand the second half of that sentence, but why would I cause more daily damage than somebody who maybe isn't?
Well, I don't know exactly what D'Angelo is getting at, but I can surmise. So racism that's outright, you can deal with that. That's piece of cake. I can see people carrying torches and say, okay, that's out there. Or comments that are made, I can identify it there. It's quantifiable. It's like a red light district right in front of my face. But the racism that is kind of more pervasive, if you will, and a little bit more hidden, that's the one that causes the more damage, because you don't see it coming. You don't know where it's coming from. And so the people who are kind of like, I got this. I'm not really racist. I don't see color. And I've done a lot of study. I've done years and years of study on racism. I'm not part of the problem. Once a person says that, then they're part of the problem, because they've stopped their process and believe that I can be trusted. And I would contend that many people of color cannot trust white people. It is just not, don't expect it. It's just not possible, because they've had too many experiences of being knocked around. I don't know if that partly answers your question, but it's an honest question. I appreciate your honesty in asking it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think part of what you said, I think when it was an article form, what it did was try to, a couple of things. One, it felt like it was trying to break the gridlock that it developed around the phrase white privilege. I'm not privileged. I only make $20,000 a year. I mean, what do you mean privilege? That kind of would try to break that through. And secondly, just what you talked about is I got this. I know this. And by knowing and acknowledging white privilege, but not surrendering any of the privilege. Yeah, you know, so you mm-hmm. have an image of inclusivity, but it never decenters you.
It never decenters.
That's what this is at.
Thank you. I won't even elaborate on that. That's perfect. If you all heard that, that's perfect. that? Yeah, please, repeat it.
Just the last.
Well, what I mean is that when you acknowledge the white privilege, it's cerebral, it's intellectual, it's all those kinds of things, but you don't get ever to hear the other person speak oppositionally to you, where it dethrones you from being at the center. So you can orchestrate racial understanding. Well, but you're not the symphony conductor. You're in the middle of it and a participant. And this pushes that farther, particularly with the broad-minded crowd.
With the broad-minded crowd. So you can appear progressive, but still be white-centered. You can still center white culture and talk the talk, but not walk the walk. Okay, yeah.
We were talking about this too. For me, one of the things that was horrifying about Charlottesville last year, when I really had a reflection on it, is that I saw in those tiki torch carrying young men just a little bit of myself. And I was horrified by the idea, but I had to admit that I think that's one of the reasons it was so disturbing for me. It was laid bare. We're exposed. We can't really hide when we're aware of the problem.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, to see yourself in those white torchbearers, white supremacists carrying signs and raising and shouting epithets, that's some insight.
Which is something I would never do.
No.
But that doesn't mean I'm not part of the problem in some way.
Yeah, I mean, you benefit from the system that they benefit from. Right. We're part of the same system. Susan?
So in reference to your question on the white progressives and how it does damage, when we lived in St. Louis and then we were moving to Portland, St. Louis is a very racist city, very overt. The N-word is everywhere. It's just like right there. And then when we moved to Portland, we thought, oh, we're going to a progressive city. It's all going to be different. There's not going to be that sort of racism all around us. And there was an African-American man we knew who said, be careful, because in Portland, it's still there. It's just covert, not overt. And he's like, I'd rather live here in St. Louis than in Portland, because it's right there. I can name it. I know it. And I'm not going to be blindsided and caught off by people who think they know what they're doing, and then they have some bias that's thrown in that they're like, they don't know how to respond because it's not obvious. So,
okay. Maybe a couple other people I've heard from. Let's see, a couple of men. Let's hear from, and a woman. Let's hear from another man. Here we go. I'm making a generalization. If I'm wrong, correct me.
Okay. You want me to go now?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So, it's become such a trigger word. And on your other slide, it said, what did it say? White privilege, and then it said advantage. And one of the guys in the group that I was talking with said, I like that word a lot better. Because I feel like I'm being indicted with the word privilege. And I could see what he was saying, you know, but that word is such a trigger now. Whenever it comes up in conversation, people freeze.
What word? Privilege?
Privilege, yeah. They just freeze, especially men. At least that's my experience in my community. I mean, it's just like, talk to me about that, you know? Even though that was the whole reason we started the conversation in the first place, and why we thought it should be with white men to start with, you know?
Yeah, white men particularly have difficulty. The trainings that I've been involved with, it's largely been white women. And white men are the least represented among them.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go to the back of the room here.
Learned enough about racism that I feel like I just forgot to talk passionately about how it hurts people. Because then it's like I have enough awareness that then I kind of overcompensate and bring an awkwardness into interactions with people of color, I think. Hopefully not too much, but I can feel it or see it. Like, why did I say that? Know, which then I could see would be more awkward than someone who's not like overthinking it. And then also like the microaggression thing, the little expressions of racism. There was some really good material I saw on that really brought it home how that messes with you, because it's not overt racism, and you don't know for sure if that person did that because of your whatever it is, your race or your gender, but you can kind of feel it, but you don't quite know, and it messes with you. And it's
it does.
Day.
It messes.
It just gets to you.
I'm a white male. I have my one privilege. The one critique I would have of my own workshop right now is that I don't have a person of color right next to me critiquing what I'm thinking. I don't have that perspective. Although, I will say this. I think what we need to do as white people is we need to have this conversation. Whatever we accomplish in the next 3 days, or if you're going out on the bus on Wednesday, whatever, however long you're here, is just that we're talking about these issues, getting these vocabulary words out here, and at least I so appreciate the honesty that you're sharing. This is awesome. Thank you. I am going to move the train forward a little bit down the tracks because I have much to cover. So, okay. I may not do the spectrum activity. What I had thought to do is move you out into the hallway there and then have you go from one side of the room to the other, but I would take 5 minutes to get out there, 5 minutes to come back, and by that time it would be time for bed. I just want you to kind of think of yourself. Think of this side of the room as yes and this side of the room as no, and mentally position yourselves. I don't know if we can... visually position yourself, maybe go like this if you're on this side, go like this if you're on this side or something, or you can be anywhere in the middle. This is a spectrum activity, so you can, the gamut is okay. So racism doesn't exist anymore. It has largely been overcome. This is the yes side. The clock is the yes side. The exit is the no side. Racism doesn't exist anymore. Yes, it has largely been overcome. Yes or no. All right. Racism has been created and can be dismantled. Made you think.
Is that two statements?
It's like two statements.
Racism has been created. All right, let's take it apart. Racism has been created.
Yes.
Yes side, no side. Okay. And can be dismantled. Oh, that's where you were wavering. Okay. All right. Racism exists to place whites on the top, economically, politically, socially, etc., and people of color on the bottom. Racism exists to place whites on the top and people of color on the bottom. Yes side, no side. Yeah, there's some division in the house here. It is more important to talk about class than race. Yes, no.
Which is middle?
Yeah, go like this, middle, yes, no. Okay, there's some middlers here. All right, we'll get into that a little bit. We live in a meritocracy where we are individually responsible for our own social and economic success. Yes, no. Okay. Race is real. There are natural racial differences between certain groups of people. Yes and no. Race is real. Race is real.
It's a real thing.
I'm sorry? I'm not going to offer definitions at this point. We will definitely get into it, but I'm just kind of understanding, figuring out where you stand. As you understand race, race is real. There are natural racial differences between certain groups of people. Yes? No. Okay. And some are abstaining. This is a little bit risky. I appreciate you getting those hands up like this. I am not judging you. I respect your hand going either way. But I understand this is kind of a challenge for some. Affirmative action is still necessary as a means of leveling the playing field among people of different skin colors and ethnic backgrounds. Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. Okay. White people today are not responsible for racist attitudes of their ancestors and shouldn't be blamed for the existence of racism. Oh, rats. All right. Sorry, language. White people today are not responsible for racist attitudes of their ancestors. Oh, good. Good. We could have a philosophical chair on this. I might do this on the last day. Okay, good. Okay, second question. And shouldn't be blamed for the existence of racism? Oh, yeah. We might get back to this question. All right. This is Current Events Edition 2.0. Kneeling during the national anthem is a valid way to protest violence against people of color. Yes? Uh-uh. Okay. Holding audience. The current administration has encouraged racist attitudes in the U.S. Okay, and yet there is division in the House, and I respect hands going both ways. Thank you. The current administration simply reflects racist attitudes in the U.S. All right. Okay, how about that? All right. Just to make you think, we'll quibble over particular words. The current travel ban against 8 countries, 6 majority Muslim, is justified. Okay. Okay, thank you. And immigrants should be allowed to serve in the U.S. military as a way to gain citizenship. Yes? No. All right. Thank you. This is one that actually just hit the news a week before I came up here, so you might have been familiar with it. Several immigrants were told, you're no longer in the military, and we're not necessarily telling you why. They were told, here's your papers, and you're gone. And they were not told why. Okay. Well, some interesting questions here. I do a little activity in my classroom called philosophical chairs. There's a couple rules to it. And maybe if we have time on day 2 or 3, I'll get back to it. It's where we kind of have a dialogue. And I think that's the practice. I do it with my students so that they can get practice talking to each other in a respectful way, not in a shoot this way, shoot again this way, thinking what I'm thinking already before you finish saying what you're saying, but to repeat what the other person says and then have a response. It's a way to respectfully have dialogue. We might do that with a couple of these questions that where there was some division. Okay. No, that's what that activity is, so we won't do that now. Here's some of my assumptions. And we will get to history here in just a moment. But racist attitudes and systems have been created and can be dismantled, I believe. Anything that has been created has been destroyed, if you believe Newton. But racism will always be part of our social fabric. It will always affect us. We all participate in racism. It is a system that is designed to give white people more and people of color less. None of us created racism, but if we do nothing to break it down, we become co-creators of it. And this is kind of a tough one for some people to swallow, but even though I'm not doing this workshop in the way that I would like to, I just decided I'm going to go ahead and do it. I wish I had a person of color with me to do it with me, but I didn't have that. I asked, but it just wasn't possible to bring somebody all the way up on the boat and make them commit to the same amount of time I'm committing. I would do it differently, but at least, you know, whatever you do might be insignificant, as Gandhi says, but it's most important that you do it. Take that step. We believe in a meritocracy, but we aren't actually in one. Many people believe that if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, no matter what color, no matter what station in life, you'll eventually make it there. Look, Barack Obama did it, and Beyonce did it. Oprah Winfrey did it. Look at them. They worked hard. We'll talk about one of these gentlemen here I mentioned before, Booker T. Washington. He's kind of this mindset in many ways. We'll get back to that. Racism is difficult to talk about, but it is important to have conversations about it, and that's exactly what we're doing now. No matter where we get to, the most important thing of what we're doing right now is having the conversation in hopefully a respectful way. Okay, well, now I don't want to, I think I might save this activity for tomorrow. I'll get back to this too. A little preview here. Okay, what is race? I'll show you the, let me just get to,
you may think you know exactly what race you are, but how would you prove that someone disagreed with you? The fact is, even though race
drives, what I might do is I might let this load in. I'll let this load up, and then maybe it'll queue up in the buffer here before I send it out to you. We'll see what happens. Well, I mean, what is race? Want to weigh in? What's race?
It's a created social construct.
Okay, right. Yeah, we've heard this. It's a created social construct. Is that what you said? Okay, awesome. Anybody want to add to that? A created social construct, yeah.
It's changed over time and changes in a place. I mean, are Irish a different race? 100 years ago, they would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
Race. But today, we think of race differently in terms of white and black rather than Irish and German.
Yeah, Europeans came over here in waves. And so you had some people, Germans, came over here early on, and you had Italians come over here a little later on. And at one point, we thought of Italians and Germans as two different races. Today, what? They're the same. You know, but it changes over time according to situation.
Well, there's only one race. It's the human race.
Okay. Okay, so why are we talking about race? Why is race such a big deal? If we're all the same, how come we're talking about it? Yeah, Dan?
Well, that's true, but in the history of this country, if you look at census records, it's very close categories. I mean, I did some genealogical research, and I was curious about this question, and there were categories like, Pick a race, white or color. So we categorize people according to skin color. That's in this country. It's not like that in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to Israel, for example, they have Jews in Israel that are very dark-skinned black, and they have Sephardic Jews, and they have European Jews. They all have this identity as a people. They have very different skin color. But in the United States, it's been about skin color.
Mm. Maybe even in other countries.
It's in other countries it is as well, of course.
Yeah.
But it's this concept of ethne or people the Bible has, for example, people groups that have an identity that are bound together somehow.
Right.
That's real. That's not going to change.
I don't mean to ignore you, Upper Balcony. I respect you, but it's harder for me to see. I got this light shining in my eyes. If you want to speak up, please do.
I've been reading recently about Bob's.
Go ahead, Lori.
About how it's not just a construct, but it's inextricably combined with slavery. So it's a social construct created to justify enslavement of some people.
Of some? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I recently read a book called My Grandmother's Hands. And the author of that book indicated that until 1790, in a research of all the newspapers that are still available in archives, you were talking about a man, it was a man, it's not a black man, it's not a white man, until a newspaper that he saw out of Savannah, Georgia in 1790. He took that forward, he pointed out that as we've gone forward with time, white slave owners wanted to differentiate between poor whites and blacks and have blacks be more subservient to poor whites because there were so many blacks. They're worried about what the impact would be in society if those blacks were to take over because there's so many of them. If you can make a division between black and white and begin to differentiate black from white, to use a derogatory term, and show that the whites are superior, we can maintain a superiority of the systems in place.
Yeah. You're right. Awesome. We will get back to that thought. Hold that thought in your mind. You know, I cannot justifiably keep you in this room for 2 hours without a break. It's hot in here. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a 5-minute. Open that door and that door. Have you walk around. Do what you need to do. We'll come back here in 5 minutes and I'll see if I can get this to work.
Perpetuation is already created. It's already there. It's moving forward. I guess that's the co-creator is the term that I'm having a hard time understanding. You know.
Thank you. So I guess what I was trying to get at was that if you know, I didn't exist 500 years ago or 400 years ago, but racism, I contend, still exists in a very powerful way in our culture. And if I just let it run the way it has always been running, then I co-create racism and continue to create it as it's continuing to exist.
Okay. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, good idea in theory.
sort of. It's not sound. I know I can volume down. I just wanted to get it.
Okay, ding. I'm going to call you back. I think part of the problem with this video is I might have a machine that just doesn't like my flash drive. I might have brought down my computer before, but it's really okay. Essentially, what this video is talking about is that race is... You've heard this before. You were telling me. It's a social construct. It's something that we've made up. But we have other social construct also. I don't know. Anybody of you have a dollar bill in your pocket? You know, money works the same way. It has zero value. What value does a dollar bill have that this piece of paper doesn't have? It's just a piece of paper. And yet we psychologically assign it a value, and we can buy lots of things with it. And it can even take over people's lives, if you will. Just a dollar bill. We make a lot of things out of nothing. We construct a lot of things, and that is not at all to say that those things don't matter. Yes, it's an inanimate object that is just laying on the table, but holy smoke, it can change people's perspective and change people's lives. You know, one of the things that the video points out is that there was a time when we went through a period in European history called the Enlightenment, and it was a time when science really took off in a great way. We were able to categorize the world. We came up with the scientific method of inquiry, where you make a hypothesis, you test that hypothesis, and then you see whether that hypothesis worked out or not. And it allowed us to really understand processes in the world and how things worked. Well, we applied it to the world, and we also applied it to ourselves, so that we started to categorize who we are. Perhaps that was the beginning of separation, that kind of either-or thinking, which in some ways helped us understand the world, but in some ways was a step back in terms of race relations. There was a man in the 1700s who started to put together a theory about different races. There were people who were from Africa. There were people from who are from Asia. There were the Caucasian race, the different races. And this really caught on. Eugenics really caught on in the early 1900s. And And this was the model for Hitler when he started to say that scientifically people are preconditioned to be better at some things and worse than others. The 1936 Olympics, of course, in Berlin was a case in point where Jesse Owens blew away that theory, but you can still hold on to your theory even if you've got hard and fast evidence. If you've got a theory, if you've got a worldview, you can still hold on to that. And race changes, as Stephen pointed out. There is the idea that if you can be... one drop of one identified race and still be that race. Even if 99% of you is outwardly one, one drop makes you that other thing. Even some states had different definitions of race so that you could go from Tennessee to Kentucky and change races. Kind of a bizarre idea. What is this concept of race that we're talking about? It's not that it's not real. Yes, it's a social construct. I completely agree with that. But it definitely makes a difference in the way we understand each other and relate to each other. All right. Okay? So that's the video in a nutshell. Yeah.
Races. I think part of that is because even though it's a fictional, scientifically fictional concept, it's had everything to do with how people experience life. Because we've organized society in a way that if you're black, your experience this world entirely differently than if you're white. And so we have this challenge, this tension between something that's actually meaningless at a scientific level and something that a social economic level.
Well said. Race. Assigned membership to a group based on physical characteristics such as hair, texture, bone, structure, and skin color. We are talking about categorizing people by the way they look, and that's what we mean by race. What I mean. That's the definition I'm going to use. Prejudice. Prejudged ideas about another person or group based on arbitrary reasons. So, all those people from Holden, they're all liberal Christians. If you walk in late to work, boy, you're really lazy. That's prejudice. And anybody can be prejudiced. Anybody of any race can be prejudiced. And then there's discrimination. And that's when you take those ideas, formed ideas and judgments, and turn them into action. Okay, well, so you're late, so I'm the boss, and I was considering you for promotion, but now I'm not. Or at least you're a notch down from where you were before. That's taking those beliefs and starting to put them into action. Or taking the action of one person, if you only have a very little experience with a person that you perceive from a different race and categorizing the entire group of people that way. Like, you're late. And so not only are you lazy, but the entire group of people who look like you and who I perceive to be like you are lazy. That's prejudice. Now, it can work both ways on these two. Anyone can be prejudiced and anyone can discriminate. I've had lots of people say to me, well, I went to this restaurant once and it was owned by a black person and I wasn't allowed to sit down. Some person actually in a workshop last year at Holden said that to me, brought up this idea that I went in and I wasn't served. So, prejudice can happen both ways and discrimination can happen both ways. It's not right either way, but we do it. The thing about racism is it can only happen one way. Can someone read this definition? Please.
Personal, institutional, and cultural structures that reinforce the idea that people with one set of characteristics are superior to people with a different set of characteristics. The dominant culture benefits at the expense of all non-dominant cultures.
All right, and so could somebody please take out their cell phone and Google If you were to Google, what is the dominant culture, in the U.S., you'd get something like, the dominant culture is white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant people. It would say that. Even Google knows that. It's not like it's some mystery. It's not like you have to be an expert to know that. Even Google. Okay, Google's an expert on race relations. But it is, I think, important to understand in our culture what the dominant culture is. White, Anglo-Saxon, I can guess, though I don't know you all, that the majority of you fall into that category. And that personal, institutional, and cultural structures benefit us at the expense of people of color, of people who are from the non-dominant cultures. Yes?
I was wondering, if you just have to sort of a shift here from physical characteristics to culture.
Oh.
Maybe you can explain, is there a connection between these? Can one be of one race and of a different culture? Or?
What a great question. This is all fuzzy. What's white? If you can go from one state to another state and be considered a different race, why, how do we even think that we can categorize it? And what is race? Is it culture? Is it language? Is it just people I feel uncomfortable around? I really appreciate you pointing out that I jumped from this thing that people look like to this thing that people bring with them from a cultural point of view. That's really, thank you. I don't know the answer necessarily beyond what I just said, because okay, here's a hand, go.
Loitering in a Starbucks. How does that, they ask a lot of questions and it's really hard to answer to the best of my ability. And I once said to them, when they said, how did this start? I said, people in power don't like to give up their power. And they asked me, are you one of those people?
Oh.
To which I started crying. But flipping from what someone looks like to their culture, I think a lot of it has to do with our perception of, how much money does this person have, or how educated are they? Do they run in the same circles that I can I relate to this person? is kind of what it makes me think of. Because if you knew someone in a Starbucks was, a wealthy or distinguished person of the community, you wouldn't say anything to them. Because you have that knowledge that they're a person to be respected. Whereas someone else who doesn't have that same status, there's different types of status.
You're covering a lot of ground here. It's hard to get at this. I mean, I'm giving you a hard and fast definition of race here, but even I question this concept of race is not easy to get around, and it's shifting. It's a shape-shifting concept.
I would challenge your last sentence about dominant culture. It's about race. I live in Minnesota. Jamar Clark was killed. He was killed in North Minneapolis, which is a predominantly African-American neighborhood. People say, well, that's a rough neighborhood. That's why the police killed him. They were fearful. Philando Castile was killed in Minnesota. He was killed in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, a primarily white community. Crime statistics are different in both communities. It wasn't about culture. It was about race.
Yeah.
Philando was stopped many times this idea that, well, it's about the dominant culture, I think, is not true.
How would you change the words?
I'd say it's about race.
The dominant race, would you say?
I think it's about white privilege. The dominant race is us people that enjoy white privilege. And the risk is, it's not about minority. We break the system in our back path. And even as our population statistics are changing, racism continues unchecked.
So you'll see this term dominant culture. I didn't invent it, but you may have heard the term dominant culture, but your point is well taken. I want to receive it and not deflect it back. I want to just kind of, I'm going to sit with it. Thank you for that. Dominant culture or dominant race? Which would you use? Dominant culture is a term that's out there, though. So maybe we're just flip-flopping. Maybe we don't even know what we're talking about. Maybe even the experts don't even know what they're talking about when they talk about race and dominant culture and that kind of thing. Thank you.
Dominant doesn't have to mean the highest percentage either.
Mm-hmm.
It means those in power.
You talk about South Africa and the apartheid. Exactly. Or the South in the United States during the time of slavery. Black slaves well outnumbered the white owners, plantation owners. And most didn't even own slaves, but we can get into that.
Is there a reason you use dominant culture?
Because it's a term that's out there. I'm actually parroting a term that's already out there. Dominant culture, if you Google it, I've heard it in lots of workshops, it's a term that's used to describe the people who are comfortable and the people whom racism benefits in a society. Yeah.
So can dominant culture be different from city to city? For example, Detroit, the dominant culture in Detroit is black. And so depending on where you go, you may have a Hispanic dominant culture in Miami or whatever. I'm just saying, is that something that you're assuming, or we're assuming is the same across the country, or is it something that differs from the area from which you may be?
Yeah, your point is well taken. Think about your geographic boundaries. Detroit is largely black, and that is the dominant culture in Detroit. But looking at the North America, the dominant culture is, look what you see in the movies. Who do you see in front of a TV camera oftentimes? What perspective do you see in whose history is told in history books as you study in middle school and high school?
Can we for a moment, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but take out the word dominant and insert privilege?
Oh.
And just for example, it doesn't matter where you are in the States, where you are, what community you're in. If you're a part of a privileged community, then that's anywhere in the U.S. So I think the way I would read dominant would be, I would kind of add privilege to that too, so it doesn't matter if I'm walking in a primarily Hispanic community, I don't necessarily feel I'm the dominant culture. I would still feel like I'm the POC.
Thank you. So whenever you see this term in print or in your travels, you'll see the term dominant culture. Maybe insert privileged culture there. We're creating language even now, I think. Go.
Well, I think the term dominant in the articles that you're referring to refer to not numbers of people, but power.
Right.
So like say privilege. So dominant, those who have the power. And that's pervasive across the U.S., no matter which city you're in.
And always in workshops it comes up, well, I've been discriminated against. I'm a white person and I've been discriminated against, perhaps. But I have felt the effects of racism too. In this culture, white people cannot feel the effects of racism. There is no such thing as reverse racism in our culture. It just can't exist because our culture is white dominant. The power structure benefits white culture. So there is no pervasive white against white racism. Okay, that got some comments going. Go ahead.
Well, I've been sitting on this thought for quite a while now. That kind of prompted me to raise my hand, I guess. But it seems like in a discussion like this, it's really hard to get our categories right for a particular reason, and it's real hard to talk about this. But one of the reasons seems to me to be that race as a social construct is a big abstract thing, but people are all individuals. And so sometimes we're talking about how you treat an individual, and sometimes we're talking about issues, like affirmative action or something like that. And then we blur it and go back and forth. And that's really, it makes it real hard for me to keep straight in my mind, at least, what we're really talking about. And so when we talk about social constructs, dominant culture, privilege, so on and so forth, then we're talking issues. I don't know how much those issues should inform us about relating to individuals.
Yeah.
Because when we relate to individuals, they might be wonderful, horrible. It doesn't matter what race they are. And yet we talk about it as if we got to get all caught up in racist ideas, either from a liberal, progressive side, or not. You know? So I don't know. I guess that's just a thought to throw out there.
But it's beautiful.
I can imagine feeling that I am a victim of racism, even if I'm white privileged in a certain group where people are treating me a certain way because of their perception of my race. Now, that has nothing to do with issues and privilege and all the rest. It has to do with my experience as an individual based on how people perceive me.
Right. Well, good. So you're giving me a segue into the next thing that I want to address, but I do want to pause here for just a second to say white people generally in culture do not experience having their last name be a reason why you don't get interviewed for a job. Somebody named Jansen doesn't experience, did I not get a call back because my last name is Jansen? Somebody whose last name is Hernandez might ask the same question. Did I not get that call back because my last name? We just don't know. So we struggle. So I want to move into a triangular way of thinking about racism and break it down a little bit from the personal that you're talking about to the institutional and the cultural. Personal racism is when we treat other people, it relates to the way we treat other people. Way that I just mentioned to you. If a boss is looking at a name on a resume and says, I don't want to interview this person because that name sounds unfamiliar to me and I don't know if I can relate to those people. That's racism. Racial epithets, racism. Calling somebody a name, the N-word, or any name that you can think of, that's personal. But that's not, I've heard from people of color have told me that that's not what they're concerned with. That's not the problem. Yes, it's a problem. It needs to be dealt with. But you're not going to win the battle against somebody who's got outward, overtly racist ideas. The thing that's even the more challenging is this part, the institutional and the cultural. Institutional racism has to do with those policies and practices that are put in place to keep things the way they are. I'll get into some examples in just a moment. Cultural racism is underpinned by beliefs. People who have certain beliefs, the way people look. What's the beautiful person? What's beautiful in our culture? It's changed, of course, over time. But cultural racism is where I hold these beliefs and I judge and treat other people according to my understanding of what is beautiful, what is good, what is right. Maybe even if you're not a Christian, I might ban you from my country because you're not fitting into my social construct of what's good. So what I believe definitely informs racism, and so does institutional laws, practices, and policies. If I can, I'm going to actually give you a couple examples, and we're going to wrestle with these. We'll do more of this. It's from Trevor Noah, Born a Crime. Awesome book. He tells this story. In Germany, no child finishes high school without learning about the Holocaust. Not just the facts of it, but the how and the why and the gravity of it. What it means. Germans grow up appropriately aware and apologetic. In South Africa, the atrocities of apartheid had never been taught that way. We weren't taught judgment or shame. We were taught history the way it's taught in America. There was slavery, then there was Jim Crow, then there was Martin Luther King Jr., and now it's done. It was the same for us. Apartheid was bad. Nelson Mandela was freed. Let's move on. Facts, but not many, and never the emotional or moral dimension. It was as if the teachers, many of whom were white, had been given a mandate, whatever you do, don't make the white kids angry. That was my insert, the white part. All right, so what's the institutional part about this? The curriculum. Yeah. And there may be other parts. There may be some personal stuff in here. There may be some culture, but I think you've hit the nail. Is what I was trying to get at. The curriculum itself is slanted a certain way and feeds into a racist system that teaches culture and history in a certain way. I have a question. There's some of you who are have gone, I assume most of you have gone through school. Before age 20, can you recall when a teacher talked about race, has had a conversation, not quite as in-depth as this, but had a conversation about race, racism, anything like that? Before age 20, can you remember in your schooling, raise your hand, if you had a conversation in a classroom about race? Okay. Interesting.
I was 6 years old, and my parents came from Germany, and my teacher was during World War II. My teacher said all the Germans should be killed.
Whoa. Is that racism? Interesting twist. What is race?
Yeah. I still remember that.
I would too.
I remember in school at exercise. Some people got triangles, some people got squares, and some people got circles. And then it was the top tier of squares, and they had all these benefits, and then the triangles had to be anything. And it was just a depiction of what was going on. It's also a classism exercise, but also that you're not the same as those other people. And then what happened and those feelings about when you didn't get as much as somebody else and all that stuff, sort of a great exercise about that.
Okay, so you did this before you were age 20.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, how about how many of you did not have this experience before age 20? How many of you did not ever have an experience talking about race in a classroom, college or high school, elementary, middle, did not have a culture conversation, don't remember one? Which is, I would guess, most of you. I didn't. And my curriculum certainly didn't put it in there. My teacher didn't think, oh, the curriculum doesn't have it. I might as well put it in there. Institutional. Okay, here's another one. Claudia Rankine actually wrote a book called Citizen. It's one of the books here. It's a book of poetry, kind of vignettes, personal experiences, maybe hers, maybe others. But she is a black woman, and she writes these various experiences that she comes upon. Can someone read this one?
The new therapist specializes in trauma counseling. You have only ever spoken on the phone. Her house has a side gate that leads to a back entrance she uses for patients. At the front door, the bell is a small round disc that you press firmly. When the door finally opens, the woman standing there yells at the top of her lungs, "Get away from my house! What are you doing in my yard?" It's as if a wounded Doberman Pinscher or a German Shepherd has gained the power of speech. And though you back up a few steps, you manage to tell her you have an appointment. "You have an appointment?" she spits back. Then she pauses. Everything pauses. "Oh," she says, followed by, "Oh, yes, that's right. I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry."
Uncomfortable laughter. Personal, institutional, cultural. Anybody want to identify beliefs being kind of underpinning some of this? Beliefs about other people? Are there laws and policies in place, institutional? Is there a personal aspect going on here?
Huh.
This one's complicated.
Well, it's scary to think she's traumatized or treats people this way.
Yeah. Just in Chicago, just last April, there was a kid who had missed his bus, and he was on his way to high school, but he was always used to getting there on the bus, so he didn't fully know which way, how to get there. So he stopped to somebody. The kid was black. He stopped someplace, and it happened to be the house of two white people, a husband and wife. Knocked on the door, or maybe it was Philadelphia. If anybody knows this story better, I'm not sure the city, maybe Philadelphia. Knocked on the door, a woman comes out and says, you know, responds in similar Doberman Pinscher fashion. And the kid's just standing there like, I'm just asking you how to get to my high school. And then the husband all of a sudden comes down with his gun and starts shooting at the kid. The kid runs away, and the story is told in the paper, he just finds an alleyway and just cries. He's absolutely, what just happened? You know, personal racism, yeah, happened to a particular person. The beliefs behind that, however, are that if a black person comes to my door, that person's dangerous and I need to protect myself. How did we get to that point? Institutional? I don't know. Is there an institutional aspect here?
A lot of neighborhoods, I can't speak to this, started off as being segregated.
Yeah.
This house cannot be sold to blacks, Chinamen, the Jew.
Right.
So those neighborhoods were set up that way. Or during the war, at post-World War II, homes in suburban areas were sold to veterans, provided they contributed to the homogeneity of the neighborhood.
Yes. Yeah.
So it very well affects a lot of neighborhoods where those are the white neighborhoods, even though there's plenty of other people who live there, it's perceived still as a white neighborhood,
yeah,
which informs the culture.
Institutionally, the neighborhoods can separate, banks can redline. It happened and still does happen where banks outline a particular area that's a good credit risk. And if you fall into our understanding of a good credit risk, then we'll sell you a house here, give you a mortgage or whatever. If you don't, find someplace else. So this woman apparently found herself in a neighborhood that she didn't belong in. All right, brace yourself for impact. Anybody want to venture to guess what state this is? Bingo. About 6 months ago, right when the suggestion was being made to arm teachers in classrooms, I wrote an article for the Oregonian about teachers should not, I would not carry a gun into a classroom. I did not bring this article, this argument up in the article, but, you know, what if, you know, walking along in this picture, a person of color stands right here with one of these things slung on all over their back.
Yeah, they can get away with that better. Those people can get away with it more than.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if you arm teachers in classrooms, I'm sorry, it's my soapbox, but if you arm a teacher in a classroom, it may work, I use the word work loosely, but what if a teacher of color had a gun in a classroom and police were to come to that school and identify in a split second who is causing the violence?
So this is a great example of the racism because we know statistically that almost all school shootings are done by white men. Yeah, when we see this, we see a guy exercising his state's right to whatever they call that, open carry.
Yeah.
Not a dangerous man who might be headed over to elementary school to shoot some people up.
Did that enter
into... statistically, we should look at that and say that guy's probably headed to the high school to shoot someone.
Yeah, and in fact, wasn't that what happened in a school where the kid actually did go on a rampage and then went to a fast food restaurant? I can't remember quite where that was. But it was one of our more recent, sadly, school. Maybe it was Florida.
Florida tended to be one of the students.
So I think it's just an example of that's cultural. We've all, like, you know, we all have that in our head. None of us, I don't know if anyone looked at that and said that's probably a school shooter. But I think there's institutional behind it, too, which is then we create all kinds of laws around that and then enforce them differently.
Well, was there ever a more blatant picture of white privilege that you've ever seen right there? And look who's behind the counter.
I know. What came to my mind was what happens if the police are coming because somebody reported a robbery, of course they're going to shoot.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, this is not Starbucks, but...
Well, and the contrast is, so the NRA is supporting this. However, I talked about Philando Castile. He had his hands on the wheel. He said, I have a right to carry a concealed weapon. And seconds later, he was killed by the police because they feared him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did.
And he was a school employee who knew every student's menu or allergy in his school. But this is okay. So when you say, is it personal or institutional? That was very personal when Philando was killed, and it was very institutional.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also a minority that killed him. He's Asian.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it's possible that white people alone aren't guilty of profiling. And we can, lots of people can do that. And can a black person be racist against a black person? I don't think so. The way that I set up the definition of racism is that there's a power and prejudice component. Anybody can be prejudiced, but only the dominant privileged culture can hold that power.
So maybe I'm confusing racism and racist, not racism, racist.
Oh.
A racist person and prejudice and confusing.
Or racism and discrimination. I think anyone can discriminate against anyone, but the way you define racism, that is, that's by definition a structural thing.
Yeah. Yeah, racism manifests in terms of personal, institutional, and cultural. Anybody can be discriminating. Anybody can be prejudiced. Anybody. But the dominant, the privileged culture can be, it only is a one-way street in this culture.
And so I just was going to say, yes, when you're talking about issues.
When you're talking about issues.
Issues. But when you're talking about personal, individual relations, I'm not sure I follow you there.
So give me an example of an issue that, let's see, so that's not the problem. So can you give me an example of the thing that you're not following, that you that would be the exception?
You said that there can't be racism in dominant culture to non-dominant culture.
No, there is. There's racism from dominant to non-dominant.
Yeah, so yes, of course there can. And so the, say, people of color live in a disadvantaged situation because things work against them systemically. Right? We accept that. But on an individual level, cannot a person, because of the perceived way they perceive the other individual's race, do something against that person because of that? We wouldn't call that racist, even if the discrimination is based on the perception of race.
No, because that's prejudice. As opposed to ism is power plus prejudice. So someone could be prejudiced against you or discriminatory, but if they don't have the power, they can't be the ism. They can't be the ism. That's just the narrow definition. It's hard to accept, but it's true.
So certainly a person of color can be prejudiced against a white person. Certainly a person of color can discriminate. I'm sorry?
Based on race,
correct. But a person of color cannot maintain, cannot be a racist toward a person, a white person in our culture. Right.
And so
it's so that person
versus discrimination.
Right.
So that, say, that person of color may discriminate against me because of my skin color, but they don't have the backing of society and of institutions in order to turn that into a power.
Yeah.
Is essentially what you're saying.
Yes, that is correct.
Can I throw
I have a couple more. Yeah, go ahead. Jump in.
Okay. My brother-in-law had a business, and he was trying to get into the Detroit system with his business. This is under Kwame Kilpatrick's administration. My brother-in-law is white, and he was trying to sell his business or get into doing water program for the city of Detroit. He was told that, number one, he was the wrong color, and number two, that if he did, he would have to pay a very large sum to even be considered with his proposal. Now, if I'm understanding this correctly, that's not possible. There was not racism there because it's not the dominant culture of our country, but it is a dominant culture with power, with this, the institution in Detroit. And that's not just him. That's been the way it is for a long time. But how can that not be racism? This seems like a double standard.
I see your point, and I appreciate you wrestling with this. In Detroit, the dominant culture, and maybe judges, and maybe banks, and maybe schools, all favor people of color. I haven't lived in Detroit. I can't speak to that. But maybe all those institutions and their cultural beliefs combined within Detroit all benefit and work toward the supremacy of black people. I haven't lived in Detroit. All right. You have an experience I do not have. Thank you for sharing it.
I think as we're wrestling with this, we have to think of society as a whole. And you can move into microcosm. That's a microcosm. And that particular person who was the mayor of Detroit, he went to jail, crooked, all kinds of stuff around there in Detroit. That's a sidebar for me. Part of my growing up is when I was in college, I had a summer job. I went with the Nazi and I went with the Black Panther. I was inspecting sewage, going down inside sewage. When you go down in a deep sewer, you got a safety line on you, and that person has their life in their hands to get you out if you get gassed by inappropriate gases in the sewer. The Nazi and the Black Panther never worked together. I work with both of them. Okay? In the south side of Chicago, except for Hyde Park, it's basically black. In the southwest side of Chicago, is white. There's a clear demarcation on the line of where that line is. The guy from the southwest side of Chicago who's a Nazi is discussing a murder that just took place in the south side of Chicago where Jewel grocery store, orange, grabbing oranges from Florida, got off of 42nd Street in the Dan Ryan in a black neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning. He asked for directions at a gas station and was shot and killed. A white guy was shot and killed by two black guys. The black guy said he had a coming, shouldn't have been in that neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning. The Nazis said he had it coming. He shouldn't have been in that neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning. They both concurred with their hatred. That was legitimate killing.
Oh, wow.
Okay? Oh, so yes. When I stand back, and I'm talking about this isn't legitimate, and we should talk about this, it's not appropriate to kill the guy. Well, I'm coming back and I say, what's the dominant culture? In our society, clearly our dominant culture is white. But you can have microcosms. The microcosm on the south side of Chicago, that is a black culture. Okay?
So I'm just curious, though, why when 99%, I'll give you the one, of racism in our country that causes most of our social economic problems, is white dominant culture benefiting to the detriment of people of color. Whenever I'm in groups of white people talking about this, we get really concerned about when black people are prejudiced. Every time. Why is that? Why are we so concerned?
Let's get back to white fragility a little bit.
All of a sudden, oh my gosh, a white guy didn't get a contract. Yeah, it happens. And for every one of those, there's a million black people that didn't get a contract. So why are we talking about that?
I haven't heard your voice.
Very quickly, we only have a couple minutes left, but we haven't even talked on Islam or Muslim.
Okay. Oh my goodness, you're right. You know, here's the issue, and here's what we're doing tonight. You're right. We haven't even gotten to what I hoped that we would get to. But you know what? This is called the history of racism. We'll get into this on Wednesday. I apologize to those of you who are going on the bus, but this is going to be podcasted, actually, or put on online. You can listen to that conversation online. But what we've done tonight is important work. We've wrestled, I think, in a respectful way. We've heard, we've listened. We haven't necessarily reached closure, but and hopefully we'll maintain confidentiality with what has been said in this room, let people speak their own truth outside of this class room. And I just want to say thank you. And I would like to also close with prayer. Let's pray. Gracious and loving God, you say, fear not. But this is hard stuff. We're not comfortable. But we thank you for giving us the courage to go where we don't want to go, but where we need to go. We pray for the evil that is in our culture, that we pray for ourselves to be able to negotiate this evil of racism in our culture in a way that doesn't react, doesn't blame, doesn't go to the guilt, but can move through it by your grace and your leading. Not knowing where we go, but only that your grace is leading us and your love supporting us through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Amen.